This is session 209, entitled Gulliver's Travels, Collaborations Among Different Worlds Within Archival Institutions. This panel was chaired originally by Russell Gazzaro, the archivist at the Reformed Church in America. I'm stepping in because Russ could not make it today. The first paper today was written by Gregory Johnson, who serves as the certified archivist for Bryn Athyn College and the associated Glencairn Museum. He holds a BA in history and an MA in museum studies. Over the years, Greg has worked as a researcher, museum educator, curator, and even historical site supervisor in addition to his present position. Gregory was also unable to be here today, so Tiffany O'Shiel of Amethyst Technologies will be reading his paper. The second presentation is by Lisa Schoberg, the college archivist and digital collections librarian at Concordia College in Moorhead, Minnesota. She earned a Master's of Art in Speech Communication at North Dakota State University and a Master's of Library and Information Science, concentrating in Archives and Records Administration at the University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee. In 2009, she earned her archival certification. Her archival passions are outreach and advocacy, particularly promoting... There's that advocacy, it just really built me up. particularly promoting archival literacy among students. In addition to the many hats she wears as a Lone Ranger, she also teaches a section of public speaking each semester at Concordia. Unfortunately, due to unseen circumstances, we have a yet there's more. Our third presenter, Kathleen Delaney, was unable to make SAA this year and will not be contributing a paper for this session. So I was going to read her paper. I am Allison Stancroft. I'm the archivist at Indiana University South Bend, and I'm a Lone Ranger. And I had volunteered to read Kathleen's paper, but I will be now moderating your questions for our presenters instead. And finally, but not least of all, is Nicole Milano, who's the archivist at the Archives of the American Field Service and AFS in Intercultural Programs in New York City. She has an MA in European History from the University of Florida and an advanced certificate in archives from NYU. Prior to arriving at AFS, Nicole served as the summer fellow at the Mudd Manuscript Library in Princeton, New Jersey, and as a graduate student employee at archives in Florida and in New York. And also, just as a last reminder to all of you, there are evaluation forms in the back for all the sessions and at the registration desk and online, and we encourage you to fill out those forms because we want to hear from all of you about the session. So with no further ado, I will leave it to the speakers.
Hello, good afternoon. My name is Tiffany O'Shiel, and again, I'm reading Gregory Jackson's paper. And his paper is entitled, Damn It, Lessons in Cooperation, Digital Assets Management, and the IT Department. So please note this presentation, while aimed at small institutions, should be applicable to larger ones as well. Either way, I'll just take up a little of your time. The first consideration for this presentation was to use a white paper, written in partnership with our IT department at Bryn Athyn College, as an example of how our archives worked across departmental lines to produce it. As I considered the idea further and notes began to go down on the paper, it became clear to me that the real story wasn't the contents of the paper itself, although that's very useful. But the important part was what had happened on an interpersonal and interdepartmental level to create a relationship between the IT department and the archives that became very collegial. So over the next few minutes, I'll give you a quick rundown of the series of events that may look like what you have done or what you may have to do in the future. Many people in academic or heritage institutions, or any other institution for that matter, see the relationship with support departments as an us versus them. We expect them to provide what we need to accomplish the real work, but we rarely exhibit openly confrontational behavior, but there's an underlying tension that does little to enhance the quality of the workspace for either party. It seems that we as archivists are always asking support departments for resources, but occasionally we may be able to offer services to them as well, even if indirectly. Over the past 2 years, I've been able to help our IT department garner some attention and resources from the Board of Trustees simply because of our shared needs. The archives at Brenathen College never had a full-time professional archivist before I joined staff. The archives had little ability to provide research materials or finding aids in digital format. And while the process will be ongoing for many years, there's at least now a web presence through the library's website or directly to collections through online search engines. Previously, archive supervision was a secondary duty for a faculty member, which resulted in actual time spent among the collections and no time for establishing relationships outside the archives. For the first few months after I arrived, there were very few requests for scanned materials because the archives had no presence on the web and nothing except for paper legacy finding aids. Luckily for me, the library director had been influenced while researching what they should look for in an archivist by Dr. Martin Levitt, who's the former ACA president, the current librarian for and a member of the American Philosophical Society, and then Temple University professor. Marty did the job of convincing the leadership that EAD finding aids were really the way to go and encouraged them to use archive software to make the collections accessible. And that set the stage for the first real interaction with the IT department, other than calling the help desk to find out why something or other wasn't working properly or was broken. After informing myself about systems through webinars, articles, and researching several software options, I realized that I would be responsible for getting the necessary information both into the system and onto the web. I didn't have time to learn how to write style sheets, and I couldn't just kidnap a member of the IT department for my personal use. As my budget was small, so I was unable to get hosted service, I chose Archon, which would enable me to get my finding aids on the web directly. I wasn't sure how IT personnel would react to using an open source program, but I decided to try anyway. And of course, since nothing is permitted to move across campus without a tracking number, I innocently emailed a request to the help desk to download, install, and customize an open source program about which they had never heard. I was honestly prepared for a long and drawn-out battle with IT admin over why they didn't allow open source programming to be installed on campus servers, etc. I was pleasantly surprised when they asked me what the program is and what it does, and so we started a discussion in person, which was very important, about the limits on storage, shortage of IT personnel, and expected obstacles. I decided to not take it as resistance. Our IT department head seemed to be honestly interested about what we had to say and what I needed, but it was balancing against resources that were available to them as well. Now, I really need to mention that Brenathen College is a small college. And when I say small, I mean really small. But most IT folks know it takes the same amount of expertise to run a Microsoft network with all the bells and whistles on a small campus just as it does on a large one. Unfortunately, while software and hardware platforms are usually scalable, the proportional relationship to college budgets is not. So while our needs are similar to that of a large college, we don't have the same budget. So guess what? Nobody codes in CSS, some software platforms are paid by departmental budgets, and some technical work has to be outsourced. The IT director and I talked for a while about what was possible, such as installing software and interfaces, and what was not, which was a lot of immediate storage space for uploaded digital material. And in the process, I gained a finer understanding of the problems that they face as well, which are pretty much the same as all of us. No money, no time, no resources. Not enough training and not enough support for those who control access to get things on that list. So that day, the IT gang gained my support, not another employee that complained about lack of IT attention and access to the latest and greatest software. The IT director and her crew got me going as what I needed. They got the program uploaded and running. Is it perfect? No. Is it running? Yes. Is Archon's color still the University of Illinois blue? Absolutely. But you can now access our finding aids, such as they are, from the web. And as a result, we haven't had an influx of requests from researchers and students at other institutions that ran across our finding aids on an online search. Temple University? Check. Villanova? Check. Princeton? You betcha. Harvard? Yale? Not yet. The next step in the relationship came when the donor offered about 500 gigabytes of oral history video that he had taken at a church congregation in West Africa. Now it was time to have that talk about loss of storage space to upload digital material. Being naturally curious, the IT department wanted to know why I needed 500 gigs of storage space ASAP. This time, I was invited to sit in on a meeting with their systems consultant, who was coming by to discuss larger campus-wide storage issues. I got my chance to explain why I needed so much storage space quickly, which, of course, the donor wanted his drives back. The archives never requested proprietary storage space in the past for the archives. They had just used a portion of the library's storage space. I explained the importance of the video to the history of our organization and broke the news to them as well that the marketing and developmental offices on campus had stopped using film cameras. That, if not all, future material would be coming from them in digital format. In fact, development had already had a few hundred gigabytes waiting on portable hard drives that were waiting for permanent storage. The problem was that the IT department had hit a budget wall since it was near the end of the fiscal year, and the finance officer wasn't excited about releasing funds for the next year to buy more storage. Since the IT department head was scheduled for a meeting with the school executives, including the finance officer and the president, she used that opportunity to make a case for releasing funds early, pointing out that it had now become more urgent, especially due to my request, that more storage become available to staff and faculty immediately. The need was also more immediate since I had uploaded much of the video as I could, which eliminated almost all of the shared storage on campus. This end result was that IT got its money, I got 500 extra gigabytes of storage space, and everyone was happy, at least temporarily. The next opportunity for cooperation, we'll call it, came when I asked to talk with the IT director about archiving born digital materials. Essentially, everything was being archived was a paper copy of a digital document, whether it was email announcements or the faculty council meetings minutes. As I explained my frustrations with trying to get cooperation from various departments, she equally voiced frustration about getting everyone to pay attention with dealing to state and federal privacy and red flags such as legislation, e-discovery, and the general lack of records organization. So we've borne a shared lack of resources. In our case, there is no central records manager on campus, and we decided to put our heads together and co-author a short white paper that dealt with the lack of records policy generally and records scheduling specifically. And while the specifics of the paper were ignored for most part, issues were raised that led to the understanding by the college administration that if they needed support from the IT department, they were going to have to provide resources for it. A couple months ago, I invited the IT director to the college coffee shop for another meeting. I asked for a little tech background on what I should do about storage and serving up approximately 4,000 slides that a donor was paying to digitize and make accessible. We spent a few minutes discussing opportunities, and then I asked the big question, why can't I have as much storage space as I want? The answer was, as you might expect, because we don't have as much money as we want, and or when we want it. For a small college, or even a large one, budgets aren't so big that IT can maintain servers and storage units that they just in case someone needs them. While growth is accounted for in annual budgets, requests for large amounts of storage just sometimes can't be met within the confines of a fiscally struggling institution. The cost of paying for engineer to design new storage solutions and maintaining server and storage stacks can quickly become overwhelming, since it generally requires adding new stacks for storage while changing out the ever slower, bulkier units. A relatively new system, to them anyway, is referred to as NetApp, and it will substantially reduce the cost of storage using a system of deduplication that demands less cost in storage and space. Very generally, NetApp removes duplicate files on a network and replaces them with wayfinders to a single file. Despite advancements in storage technology, the increasing demands for storage of digital materials will soon require the installation of even more servers despite the more efficient technology, and costs will begin to rise again. I was given the opportunity of hosting my material offsite if I chose, which I understand is not always an option or affordable to some archives. Other options were available as well, including cloud storage, local storage such as RAID arrays and portable hard drives, and CDs, but all those come with costs and other drawbacks. Cost control, security, and privacy will greatly very greatly depend on the type of storage that you require and desire. Do you need some extra storage for digital photographs? Did you want to maintain it on site, online? Do you want computing space in the cloud, or do you just need storage? Do you need to run software off the vendor's platform? Do you need IaaS, PaaS, or SaaS, or simple storage, block storage? The levels, types of accessibility, and security in the cloud or other platforms are beyond the scope of this talk, but they do need to be understood and considered by the end user, which are the archives. In addition, it is possible that digital storage costs will be pushed down to the department level so that users have to be more careful about their digital storage solutions instead of just saving everything. So these constant communications with the IT department have taught me about how they operate, what their obstacles are, and how they can run, and how they can and can't help. Here are the top 10 takeaways that I've learned and maybe you can try. One, keep your data storage lean. Don't be a data pig. Start the discussions now for how money in your departmental budget can be used to purchase additional storage solutions, so if it comes up, then you have the money. Take extra time to contact a real person in IT to talk about issues. Don't just rely on the help desk person, although in many cases that works fine, but you need to talk to someone in person. You should meet the head of your IT department in person as well, or someone at least that you'll be dealing with on a regular basis. And you should buy them coffee. Brush up on your hardware, servers, RAID arrays, standalone drives, etc. Learn the terminology and what they mean so you have a basic understanding and vocabulary of the process and the costs that are involved to the IT department. You should educate yourself on the different types of cloud storage and ask IT to explain to you how their system works. You should also ask their advice, whether it's solicited or unsolicited, on help decide what you should do. Ask if there's anything that you can do to help make this work as well. And don't begin the question with, can't you just? And thank you for listening, and good luck with your cross-departmental archives. Thank you.
Good afternoon. I want to start my presentation by telling you a story that happened on my way here, actually, and it was quite entertaining. And maybe some of you have experienced this as well. I sat down on my first flight on my way here from Fargo, North Dakota. We're not like the movie, so just keep that in mind. Next to a gentleman named Danny. He had a goatee and glasses and some piercings, and we struck up a conversation about what we do for a living. And I mentioned I was an archivist. And in addition to his puzzled look on his face, he said, an archa-who? So I proceeded to go on and tell him about what archives are and what archivists do. Now, the good thing about being an archivist in such a situation is that, unlike pastors or psychologists, I was not questioned about marital advice or self-care, nor even how to best preserve family photographs. The negative side of the coin, however, is that this situation reminded me of the lack of awareness and skewed perceptions society has about archives, and I found this photo that I find pretty entertaining. After all, our reality is not typically what is seen in the movies. We do not hang out of fast-moving vehicles, clutching rare documents in evening gowns, nonetheless, nor work in the bowels of a building surrounded by dust with no exposure to humanity. My reality is that I have a lean staff. Plenty of work to go around, and few resources beyond my ingenuity and creative fiscal management at my disposal. And I'm guessing that many of you may be in a similar spot. I used to feel that I was a single fish advocating for the archives in the sea that is Concordia College, the blue fish being me. But I adopted Dory's mantra from Finding Nemo. Have we seen Finding Nemo? Yes. Which is, just keep swimming, just keep swimming. I am happy to report that as I have kept on swimming, I have been able to operate the Concordia College archives as a bridge from the tower to the town in order to popularize the concept of archives and create meaningful programs that educate and inform. My portion of our session will focus on archivist as somewhat of a PR specialist. I am going to highlight some of the methods that I have used in my small shop. While many of these methods are specific to academic archives, I will attempt to broaden them so that they are transferable to the many of you who work in religious, corporate, or library, or other settings. To do so, I organize my talk based on the inreach I perform with constituents on campus and the outreach I perform with the broader community. And then I'll close with some communication strategies that we use in general. I firmly believe that archives exist to be used. This use of collections certainly justifies existence, but more importantly, contributes to a thoughtful society. The mission of Concordia College is to send into the world thoughtful and informed men and women dedicated to the Christian life. The words thoughtful and informed in this mission statement provide an excellent vehicle and rationale to continue making archives a household word. Recently, we had tremendous success with starting an internship program on campus. And we do a fair amount of work with teaching with primary sources. But I thought rather than talk about things some of you may have heard me speak about before, I'd highlight the internship program, which is something new. So we break our internships into three categories, as you can see on the screen. So general, for lack of a better term, is a category that's designed for interns looking for a more typical archival experience that provides exposure to the archival functions and special projects such as digitization. And this one has been mostly attractive to history and English majors, but certainly any major would be welcome to pursue that one. We have also done some internships with public relations. So interns in this category advocate for the Concordia College archives through established means, but also coming up with some new ideas. So it is through this internship program, or this one that we started last year through PR, that we were able to get on Facebook. I hadn't yet had time to do that, and students being very savvy were able to take that on. I'd like to think I am savvy, but just didn't have the time. And this coming year, our big initiative with PR is to have our first American Archives Month campaign on campus, and we're really excited about doing that. So this internship category has been well-suited for communication studies and marketing students. And then finally, curricular slash education is still kind of formulating in my head. I haven't had an opportunity to actually engage students in this yet. But what I hope to do is have students from our education department write lesson plans that use the sources in our collection, and then be able to post those up online for teachers in our area to come and use, and then eventually to digitize collections that coincide with that and provide some resources for our local area and beyond. I've also been wanting to do history topics and to highlight our collections, listing sources and that kind of thing to help students for NHD or similar projects, and I'll show you an example of how we're starting to do that now. But that's another way that I could see this category doing some helpful stuff for us. While I had every intention of advertising these internships on our website, I have been so fortunate to have had the success spread like wildfire through campus, and students flocking to my office, I'm just honored that they're so excited about this, asking me to come and intern in the Concordia College Archives. So just to provide a snapshot about this success, I thought I'd share a quotation from one of my favorite interns, Miss Katie, who wrote the following in her journal. "Today was my last official day as an intern in the Concordia College Archives. I couldn't have been more thrilled with my experience here. Since my intent is to attend graduate school and pursue a career in history with hopes to work in a museum, this experience was extremely fruitful and beneficial. In working with and understanding the inner complexities of an archives, I have added depth to my historical focus and my ability to use resources and effectively research, to familiarize myself with the processes of description, and to understand the thought process that goes into the many dimensions of historical preservation." Reading this quotation makes my heart smile every time I read it. I have been very fortunate to have had Katie stay on as a student worker in the archives, and I hope that this internship program will continue to do that so that we can retain high-quality student workers that are getting familiar with it through their internship program. But the internship program has not been without its challenges and benefits, so I thought I should highlight those. As I designed the internship program, I selected readings that provide the theoretical framework, so the students are getting practical experience that is coupled in our theoretical foundation. That has taken some time. I also work very closely with the students so that they are I talk to them about their goals and what they're seeking to accomplish so that we can marry those goals with the needs we have in our archives. So the internship then is very fruitful for both of us. So tailoring the internship has made a lot of more work on my end. Also preparing the work and then checking the work has taken some more time. I have not personally experienced this challenge, but some colleagues in corporate archives have mentioned some challenges with HR and employee classification and the pay for interns, so that may be something you want to think about if you're in that setting. But despite these challenges, the internship program has provided many, many benefits that would be experienced regardless of the type of institution in which you work. So just quickly to highlight those. It's created excellent collaborations with the departments in the Concordia, in my case. Specifically, in an academic setting, I was able to work with the Office of Cooperative Education to get that started, and that really opened their eyes into what we do and how to connect students with us, and also with academic departments. It's connected top-notch students with an excellent high-impact learning opportunity, which would happen, again, regardless of where that internship is happening. It's produced high-quality work to advance the archives, collections, and services, increased awareness of what we're doing. It's retained motivated, intelligent students to keep working in the archives, or perhaps it would retain volunteers. And finally, it's integrated the Concordia College Archives into the curriculum at yet another level. So this internship program has enhanced the Concordia College Archives' reputation for teaching and learning on campus, which is a fundamental goal of Concordia College's mission. Not only have faculty and students been using the archives more as a result, which is great, but also administrators are becoming more aware of what we do and the importance of it. Also very great. A key way that we have been continuing to help administrators understand what we do is through assessment. So I've been amping up our assessment program because that is a dialogue that administrators, of course, understand. So to do that, I have again focused my assessment efforts on teaching and learning to start because that's the primary mission of Concordia. So we have developed some learning outcomes, and you can see those on the screen. They range everywhere from the formulating research questions at the start of a project to taking the information that the students have gathered and creating a product. So to assess those, I turned to the Archival Metrics Project. I'm guessing most of you are familiar with that. I looked at the teaching support instrument, which you see up on the screen here, as well as the student researcher instrument, also on the screen now. and I adapted that slightly to meet my needs. But I found the archival metrics toolkits very, very helpful, easy to use. And the great thing about them is I use them for teaching and learning, but there's instruments, let's call them that, for online finding aids to assess your websites, lots of things. So if you don't have needs for teaching and learning, you would very well find something there that you could use. And it would be a great place to just dive in and use as a springboard to create your own assessment program if you are looking to do so. So I wanted to mention what I'm going to call the middle ground. In an academic institution, we have a fair amount of people that are connected to the institution but not actually there. And I think they're really important to consider. These are our alumni and our donors, because they often have the information that we're seeking to preserve and sometimes even the money to help us do that or to accomplish other things. So we have done specific outreach efforts with them as well to keep them involved with the institution. Again, we have turned to our teaching and learning. So we have done some projects with classes, interviewing, which is a communication studies course. The students interview alumni and do oral history interviews that are then added to our collections. It's a really great project. Another example, this coming fall, we're doing a pilot project in which some history, 100-level history class, is going to be creating websites for the reunion classes. So they're going to come up to the archives, and they're going to sleuth and find photographs and newspaper articles, whatever, create timelines and compile all that on a website. That is going to allow the alumni then to participate in that discussion, because you can upload files and participate and have a participatory archives, which I'm really pumped about. We also create an exhibit every year for homecoming that plays off the homecoming theme. This exhibit that's on the screen was about the symbols and trademarks at Concordia College. It was pretty fun to put together. And finally, we work very closely with our advancement office. They contact us very regularly for information about our alumni or donors, most of it genealogical, that they can then take to the donors and therefore pull them in. But that's great. It's very helpful for everybody. So we've developed close relationships with them, and one donor in particular, this is President I.F. Gross, the first president of Concordia College. His descendant came up to the archives and visited with us, and he did some genealogical research, and it was really fun to meet him. And he just got so excited about this. So he decided that he would help us go find more information about I.F. Gross, so he has funded multiple trips, and he also funded us creating this exhibit. So that's been really great. So our work with sharing collections extends beyond Concordia, and I am a huge proponent of integrating primary sources into the curriculum, as you have heard from Allison. My all-time favorite quote, which I say I think at every presentation I give, so forgive me if you've heard me speak and have had me share my love of this quotation, but it is, as you see on the screen, from Julia Hendry's 2007 article, "What better way to ensure that the policymakers and voters of tomorrow are both critical thinkers and sensitive to archival concerns than to introduce them at an early age to the usefulness of archives?" In addition to my Just Keep Swimming theme song, this mantra provides me a lot of motivation to continuing on this path. So a key way that I do that outside of Concordia is through NHD, National History Day. So we've worked with students individually, and we've also worked with classes that have come up to the archives and used our collections for their projects. This toolkit, the Reference Access and Outreach Section NHD Task Force compiled and created, and it has a lot of great information for teachers and students, as well as archives and that side of the coin. So if you are involved in NHD and are looking for more information, or if you are not and want more information, I highly recommend checking it out. It's free and a great source. So The in-reach and outreach methods that we do rely heavily on the communication strategies that we employ. So here is our Facebook page. We're up to 103 likes. That's actually gone up, and I know that's not a lot, but it's still exciting for us. And I'm really excited to use the timeline feature of Facebook and populate that with the institution's history, so that's one of our goals there. We've also redone our website recently using Weebly, which is a free software program to design websites. If you are not a website person and don't like HTML and such things, this is the way to go because it is as simple as dragging things down into the page and populating the content. And I think it looks smashing, but I am biased. So that is what our homepage looks like. My philosophy about archives is that I want to put the information my users need in their hands as quickly and easily as that can happen. So that has been what my philosophy as I've designed the website as well. So here are a couple things we have done. We have in the archives a book called our Ready Reference Notebook, and that contains listings of information that were frequently asked, such as who was the homecoming queen in 1938, and we can just simply go there and find the answer. So, since those are frequently our questions, why not give that to our users and make it as accessible as possible? So we put them all up online. And you'll see the list there, and then each link connects to whatever that listing happens to be. This one's the Christmas concert program themes. We've also started those history topics pages that I alluded to earlier. So this one is about our China missionaries collection. We have five women that did that were affiliated with Concordia. So we summarized what the collection is and then talked about a few ways that could be used. And then we found a really cool product called Spicy Nodes, which is a way to do virtual concept mapping. So that's what you see on the bottom of the screen there. And I exploded it just so you could see it a little bit more. I wish I could do it virtually for you. But you can select any one of those nodes and pull it around, and the user can see how that topic works with everything else. We decided that we wanted to highlight our primary sources and secondary sources, so that's what we connected to the various people, but it's very flexible. We also have a number of digital exhibits, and we do create those with Omeka. And you see one about our buildings and, again, IF Gross. Just to provide you another example of ways that you can save time, we write a monthly feature every month for our alumni newsletter that's distributed electronically. So the one you see on the right there is about Concordia buildings. So we also create a physical exhibit in the library lobby each month about that topic, and then we can use the text that I already wrote, and then we compile the text and the physical exhibit and mash it all up and stick it online with Omeka. So we're able to create a nice workflow through doing that. So whether you call it working smart and hard or killing two birds with one stone, working in a Lone Ranger situation necessitates creativity and strong communication skills. This afternoon, I've highlighted just a few of the strategies that I have found successful in reaching out to our constituents. As I continue to swim upstream in my journey of making archives a household word, I have found that the back current is getting weaker and more fish are joining my cause. I find this exhilarating, empowering, and exciting. Just keep swimming, just keep swimming, just keep swimming, swimming. Thank you.
Hello. So the presentations today have shown how two Lone Rangers have maximized the potential of their repositories by working with staff and students who are not professionally trained archivists. By working within these various worlds of our institutions, we as Lone Rangers are not only improving the state of our archives, but are also leading to a greater awareness of what an archive is and what archivists actually do. So in my case study today for the Archives of the American Field Service and AFS Intercultural Programs, better known by its shorter and much easier name of the AFS Archives, I want to continue in this thread by describing my interactions with three departments within the international nonprofit organization where I work. These departments have assisted me in my efforts toward advocating to several internal audiences within AFS Intercultural Programs. However, before I get into the details of this internal advocacy, I want to first contextualize this within the history of the organization and also the history of the American Field Service. So the American Field Service was founded during World War I by A. Pied Andrew, who is the dapper gentleman with the cane in the photograph at the right. After an unsuccessful bid for a seat in Congress, Andrew traveled to France to volunteer at the American Ambulance Hospital of Paris shortly after the outbreak of war. During his time at the hospital, Andrew standardized the type of ambulances used to the quicker and more maneuverable Model T Fords, and also brought the ambulance drivers closer to the front lines of battle. With the help of representatives in the United States, Andrew helped to recruit nearly 2,500 ambulance and camion drivers from the United States who wanted to be involved in the French war effort in some way. Now, in 1917, the United States entered the war and actually absorbed the American Field Service, which ceased to exist as an independent entity at that point. But by the time of militarization in 1917, AFS drivers had participated in every major French battle, including the Battle of Verdun, which was one of the longest and bloodiest battles of the First World War, and they had carried more than 500,000 wounded from both sides of the war. AFS was reactivated as a voluntary ambulance corps in 1939 at the start of World War II. AFS ambulance drivers served mainly with the British forces and the Free French forces under Charles de Gaulle. And AFS drivers were with the Middle East forces in the Western Desert and North Africa, the Central Mediterranean forces in Europe, and the Southeast Asia Command in India and Burma. This time, however, AFS was not absorbed by the U.S. military when they finally entered the war in late 1941. By war's end, AFS drivers had carried over 700,000 Allied and Axis casualties. Some of the AFS drivers also assisted in the evacuation of the Bergen-Belsen concentration camp, which had been liberated by British forces in April of 1945. And this photograph on the screen shows one of our drivers peering into the gates of the camp shortly after they were helping to evacuate the prisoners there. And we have many photographs from this event, as well as a short video in color of the evacuation efforts and of the British forces burning the barracks to the ground after they had evacuated all the prisoners. In 1946, AFS ambulance drivers from both World Wars gathered in New York City for a reunion. One of the tasks of this reunion was to determine where the funds remaining from the war were to go. Now, as I mentioned before, AFS was a voluntary organization, and so the staff had embarked on these large-scale volunteer and fundraising efforts during both wars to raise money, especially for the purchase of ambulances. Now, some of the AFS drivers, particularly in World War II, had been registered as conscientious objectors, and they really believed that AFS was a peaceful organization that was created in the midst of war. So at the reunion, the drivers decided that they had experienced a positive intercultural exchange by working with these foreign militaries during the war, and they wanted to continue this intercultural dialogue with new generations. Therefore, the remaining funds were used to begin what today is known as AFS Intercultural Programs, which is a nonprofit international organization that is present in over 110 countries around the world, with over 44,000 volunteers and nearly 13,000 student participants every year. Now, the AFS Archives was officially founded in 1980 to document the history of AFS, beginning with the founding of the American Field Service in 1914 and through the present-day student exchange programs. In the AFS archives are records and photographs from the organization in its various phases, personal collections of the ambulance drivers, and also memorabilia. Due to various reasons, however, the access to and maintenance of the AFS archives was very limited for a number of years, to put it lightly. In 2009, AFS staff realized that more needed to be done in order to preserve and make accessible the material in the AFS archives, particularly as the centennial of the organization was approaching in 2014. AFS staff applied to the NHPRC for a basic processing grant, which they received in 2010 when I was hired as a project archivist. Just a quick side note about this slide. Prior to my arrival at AFS, they had moved the AFS archives to the American Partner Office, which was located in New York City. So all of a sudden, the AFS office had this mysterious entity in the back corner of the office. Literally, we're in a back corner. I have my own side entrance where really nobody sees me. I just come in and out and go straight to the archives every day. And so all of a sudden there were these locked doors and this sort of mysterious part in the office where they couldn't go. So I started giving presentations to the staff to show them that I wasn't a scary person, that this was a great place in the back corner of the office, and really why they couldn't just go through and ruffle and through the boxes. And so this slide was used where we would start the presentation and say, what is an archive? Is it where Google sends your emails? And so we would just start talking about what an archive actually was. So back to the NHPRC grant. The goals of the NHPRC grant were to obtain basic intellectual and physical control over all of the World War I and II collections in the AFS archives. So this was accomplished through a survey of the 175 cubic feet of archival material for these collections, the creation of 170 coherent collections based on the provenance of the material, the installation of a content management system, ARCON, and the creation of 55 basic finding aids and MARC records, which were then cataloged. We also created a website for the first time, which you see here, featuring news stories related to the archives, digitized material, finding aids, and also information on accessing the material if anybody wanted to use it for research. The results of this project were also promoted to both internal and external audiences, including through the website. Now, once the NHPRC grant project was finished in the summer of 2011, I was kept on as the full-time archivist at AFS. Though the grant was over, I wanted to keep up the progress and the modernization of the AFS archives that started with the grant project in 2010. Now, finding myself a lone arranger for the first time in this position, it was a bit overwhelming to realize that I didn't have some of the resources, staff, or helpful advice of fellow archivists that I had at the larger institutions that I'd worked for in the past. The publicity related to the grant and the new availability of the AFS collections meant a great increase in the number of research requests for the war and student exchange program collections. However, the grant had only covered the World War I and II material and not any of the student exchange program material, which was nearly twice as large as the World War I and II collections and had pretty much no arrangement and description for any of the material. And it also didn't cover any of the memorabilia, which you can see or not see in the boxes stacked to the ceiling in this photograph, which was one of the things I encountered after the grant was over. Then, of course, in addition to these behind-the-scenes archival activities, I wanted to continue advocating for the AFS archives, particularly internally, which is really the focus of this presentation. Now, our internal network includes international staff from 50 partner organizations around the world, ambulance drivers and their families, 13,000 current students, and over 400,000 alumni from around the world. While this was a bit overwhelming at first, what I realized was that while I don't necessarily have all the archival resources I need, I do work with extremely talented non-archive staff who, with the right approach, are usually very willing to help with AFS. And these staff members are really great at promoting and advocating for the student exchange program, so I just needed to find a way to shift that advocacy and talent toward the AFS archives. So the first main example I want to use in my case study of AFS internal advocacy and inReach is my work with the marketing team. More specifically, the item of the month featured on our website, which is circled in yellow here, that helps us reach our first target internal audience, which are the AFS current students and alumni for the student exchange programs. While some of the archival collections in the AFS archives do not have the arrangement needed yet to digitize all the material, not even to mention the resources to do that, I wanted to bring to light some of the interesting items that we have in our collections each month. So the items are usually timed to certain events related to the history of the organization, our staff, or other significant events in history. So for example, on the 50th anniversary of John F. Kennedy's speech to AFS students on the lawn of the White House in 1961, we posted a photograph of this event and also an audio file from a later speech that he gave. And this has really been one of the key items on our website. Anytime we have students that come through the office to just get a tour of the archive, I always mention the speech to them. And while they may not know the details of the Battle of Verdun or how the Monte Cassino Monastery was bombed in World War II, I suddenly mention JFK's name and their eyes light up. It doesn't matter where they're from, they always know JFK. So it's a really great item to sort of bring people into the history of the organization. And the words that he said during the time of the speech are still relevant to the students today. So it's been a really key item for us. So I also work with the marketing team to post the item of the month to the main AFS Intercultural Programs Facebook page, which has over 88,000 followers around the world. Now, the item of the month featured here is a photograph of Sidney Howard, who was an AFS World War I ambulance driver who also won a posthumous Oscar for writing the adapted screenplay for Gone with the Wind, which is one of my favorite movies. So when this image was posted to Facebook, a question was also posed with the image, asking if followers could figure out what he won an Oscar for, and with a hint that the answer was on the AFS Archives webpage. So this photograph had 90 likes. If y'all are familiar with Facebook, the like is the thumbs up. It actually had 91, but I'm not counting my own, and 13 shares. So also a number of followers posted a link to the AFS Archives webpage in the comments section because they had found the answer there, so which meant that they were actually aware of our site, even if it was only the first time that they had visited this site. And I want to also mention that we posted another image to Facebook within the last couple of months, and it wasn't necessarily an item of the month, but it was very popular. It was a photograph of just students dancing in Madrid in, I think, the 1960s for a Valentine's Day dance, so we posted it on Valentine's Day. This image had 249 likes, 25 shares, and a number of comments regarding the love stories that the AFS students had experienced on their program, so it's quite an interesting read. So my second example of internal advocacy comes through my work with the AFS development team on a newsletter entitled The AFS Janus, which helps us to reach our second main internal audience. The AFS Janus has a circulation of nearly 2,000, which mostly goes to the former AFS ambulance drivers and their families. Now, the publication was started in the 1980s by the archives and communications teams as a way to just really keep the drivers in touch with each other over the years and report on marriages and things like that, and also to keep them in the loop about the student exchange programs. However, the publication slowly got away from the AFS archives when it was taken under the umbrella of the development department. But by working with the development team when I arrived, the last few issues have included many more stories about the AFS archives and what we've been doing. Now, one of the most successful parts of this new newsletter initiative that we've been doing from the archives comes through researcher stories, where they describe their research in the archives and how it's impacted their life. Now, of course, my inspiration for these stories came from SAAs I founded in the archives campaign, particularly because the new level of access that we have to the AFS archives following the grant has allowed us to bring in researchers from around the world. Now, this particular story featured here comes from a woman named Danila, who contacted me about a year ago and had found the AFS Archives website through just a basic Google search online. Danila was looking for information about the American Field Service, who she claimed had stayed in her home just outside the historic center of Florence during World War II. Danila's mother had been sent to a concentration camp and then was released to live in the United States in a prisoner exchange during the war, leaving 13-year-old Danila and her young brother at home with the servants and family friends. From the U.S., Danila's mother arranged to have AFS stay at her home, and the ambulance drivers arrived little more than a week after the Germans destroyed nearly all of the bridges crossing the Arno River in Florence, with the exception of the Ponte Vecchio. Danila and her brother had already moved to the ground floor quarters during the bombings, and so AFS occupied the upper level of the villa. Through some research in the World War II records, I was able to make the connection that what AFS had referred to as our convalescent villa was in fact her former home, the Villa La Querci. This was confirmed when I sent her this image pictured here, and she said she became teary-eyed as she realized that this was the dog that she had to leave behind during the war when she was finally reunited with her mother in the United States. These photographs of her dog and the villa were not just any photographs, however, but Irving Penn photographs that he had taken during his stay at the convalescent villa. Irving Penn, who was a famous fashion photographer, worked for Vogue and some other other magazines, had actually volunteered with the American Field Service as an ambulance driver during the war. So this was really a fascinating story of discovery for us as well as Danila, and we wanted to share this story with others. It was as simple as that. And once we published this, it's been one of the stories that we've gotten the most positive feedback from researchers and students and staff, and it's just been a really positive response to this. Now, finally, my third example for this case study isn't actually from one department, so I cheated a little bit in my wording. Instead, the team here actually refers to a representative from every AFS partner office that assists me in helping to reach AFS staff and volunteers worldwide, which are our third and fourth internal audiences. While I do work with the American development and marketing teams to post material to the website, after speaking with international staff members, I realized that some of them weren't aware of what we were putting online, and some of them weren't even aware that we still had an archive. So for some strange reason, they weren't in the habit of checking my website every day or even monthly. I don't know why. So in order to encourage more traffic to the archive and also just awareness of the website and what we have in general, I started doing something very simple. I sent an email. Now, I'd been sending an email to the staff in the American Partner Office where I worked since the start of the NHPRC grant and had really gotten very good feedback about this. The emails would really just announce things like new accessions. I would put, a newly accessioned letter on my desk and people would come by and look at it. Or I would announce that we'd put up an exhibition board for visitors. And so by doing this, along with presentations to the staff about what we have in the AFS archives, the scary back corner of the office became really just less scary and less mysterious and just became very interesting to them. So now I hear staff members bringing people down to my office to see the exhibit board, and I hear them saying, "This is my favorite part of the office." So it's been a really good experience. Now, because of the success with the American staff, I really wanted to expand this method to the international staff around the world. So I began sending an email directed to one staff member at each of the 50 partner offices. So while I can't feature the actual items or talk with them in person, I can do it virtually and remotely. This email is really just a summary of what the AFS Archives has been doing to make international staff feel a part of it. The important thing about these emails is that they are very short and to the point, while also trying to keep their interest. So an example is here. I just posted a photograph from a World War II track and field day event that they had in Pisa when the drivers were waiting to be shifted to a new theater of war. And so I posted this right before the Olympics, and I just included a brief summary of what it was, and if people are interested, they can click on the link, and it takes them to the page on the website that has more information. And I try to change the language to include everyone by saying, take a look at one of our own high jumpers from AFS history as we start the Olympics this week. And so I just try to include them in the language that I use to make them really feel part of it. So here are just a few examples of the positive remarks that I've received about these emails from staff around the world. And they can be very short, just with a little emoticon saying, "I like these emails." Some of them let me know how they're incorporating what I send around into their staff orientations or their volunteer orientations. And sometimes these emails arrive a month after I sent the email, so right before the next one goes out. But it doesn't matter because I know that they're reading them, and that's really the most important thing to me. Now, I would be lying if I said that everything is sunshine and rainbows at AFS. And just as a side comment, this is an actual picture of our staff members. We had a volunteer day in New York City where we painted a fence at a local school. So working with development can be a little tricky sometimes. I am also involved in a current email battle with the marketing manager, trying to get him to post the high jumper photograph to Facebook before the Olympics are over. And I also recently spoke with one of our national directors from an international office who told me that he had never received a monthly email. So apparently the person in his office was not sending out the emails to everyone like they were supposed to. Also, the AFS Archives really does suffer from a lack of resources and personnel. Though, of course, this is not unique to any archive, particularly a Lone Ranger one. Now, with this internal advocacy, we do get a lot more traffic to the archive, both in person and remotely, which is really great, but it also comes with questions like, why isn't everything digitized yet? Typical, I'm sure you've all heard that one before. And occasionally, the internal advocacy just does not work. Sometimes what I encounter are a bunch of underpaid, overworked, sometimes jaded nonprofit staff from around the world. Why would they care about the AFS archives when they're worried about sending and hosting 13,000 students amid global crises every year? At the end of the day, however, most really do care. AFS staff, former drivers, volunteers, students, and alumni share an interesting and humanitarian history and have similar goals to promote intercultural education and understanding throughout the world. Furthermore, we will all be celebrating this history together for the centennial of our organization in 2014. Now, we don't always agree with decisions that are being made or why things are done at AFS, but at the end of the day, we're a team and we have to work together. I have to be just as flexible and sometimes more so if I want to see results in the archive. On the other side, by promoting the AFS archives and the history of the organization, the other AFS staff have found a really wonderful tool for basically fundraising and recruiting students for the program. So it's been a symbiotic relationship and we really do learn from each other. Now, while at first bemoaning my status as a Lone Ranger with the first real job of my career, I've now found it to be extremely rewarding in many ways, and have found that with the right approach, people can be very willing to help. Furthermore, to me, the staff, students, alumni, and ambulance drivers of AFS who are still very active in the organization are a new audience for the archival community, many of whom have never encountered an archive before, including their own. Some staff now include the archives in their daily language about the organization, and I'm really looking forward to expanding this into more international partner offices around the world. So with the right approach, and sometimes something as simple as an email, your archive can be the favorite part of your office, too. Thank you. So I'll pass it over to Allison for questions.
You all have any questions for our speakers? Yes. So I'm going to repeat the question so everybody hears it. So the question was for Nicole, and tell me if I'm getting this right.
Do I advocate for donations from the partner offices around the world?
And do you get
any? Well, first of all, we do advocate for physical donations to the archive through various forms, both on the website and in the AFS Janus. We make an announcement that we're looking for new material, and we've been consistently getting in new material related to our World War I and II collections. However, officially, the AFS Archives only collects material related to AFS International, which is the head organization for all of the partner offices around the world. But we're currently working on a survey of our international partner offices to determine what type of material they've been keeping since the 1990s when they officially broke off and became their own partners. So we're working on a survey, and we're also working on a records retention policy for all of the partner offices with our legal team to implement it both in AFS International, the head organization, and also the partner offices. And we're also, with that, including recommendations on how to store their permanent material, what we've deemed as permanent and archival material. So the AFS archive space where I work is actually quite small. It's only three small office rooms that we've converted into storage. So we don't have the room for that, but we want to encourage our partners to continue keeping their material, providing them with information on how to do so, and then hopefully in the future, they'll buy us a beautiful brand new building with climate control and we'll be able to store everything there.
Others? Yes.
Yes, hi. I'm sorry, I'm a little bit Midwest accent challenged. Lisa, how do you spell the website builder?
The website builder is Weebly, Weebly.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Anyone else? Okay. Well, thank you so much for attending our session. And enjoy the rest of your SAA experience. And if you can just remember to fill out your evaluations, we'd really appreciate. Thanks, everyone.